Hello everyone and welcome to this week's Big Boat interview, which we are running in place of our regular boat briefing. This is because we didn't want to waste any time in getting this podcast out there. It features two gentlemen of vast experience in the world of deep sea exploration. Patrick Leahy, the co-founder of Triton Submarines, and Rob McCallum, the co-founder of EOS Expeditions. I was desperate to get Patrick and Rob on the podcast to discuss the recent Oceangate submarine tragedy, which saw five people lose their lives on a descent to the Titanic. Both Patrick and Rob knew some of the passengers on the sub extremely well and were genuinely affected by the disaster, not only for the loss of dear colleagues and friends, but also because they both saw it coming, as you will learn very shortly. This is the first time Patrick has spoken to anyone about the incident, despite repeated calls from the press. Rob, meanwhile, you might have seen on various news programs because it was revealed he wrote an email to Oceangate CEO Stockton Rush 5 years ago warning him he was risking disaster by pursuing his ambition to dive the Titanic in that particular submersible. Anyway, that's quite enough from me. I hope you enjoy this fascinating insight into the world of deep sea exploration from two men who know it better than anyone. Hello everyone, and thank you for joining us for the Big Boat interview, which for the first time I think features two interviewees, Patrick Leahy and Rob McCallum. Is it McCallum or McCullum? It's McCullum, right?
McCallum.
McCallum, right.
Like the whiskey.
Right, we'll just keep all this in. It's good. So Patrick is the co-founder of Triton Submarines, and Rob is the co-founder of EOS Expeditions. And these are two gents who know as much as there is to know, really, about deep sea submersible operations, which might give you a clue as to what we're going to be talking about today. And that's obviously, or partly, the Oceangate disaster, which happened in June, obviously, that saw five people very sadly lose their lives on the descent to the Titanic. And we're going to talk about deep sea operations more generally, how to do it safely, why class is important, and a bit more about your respective companies. Thank you very much for joining us, Patrick and Rob.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Stuart. I appreciate having an opportunity to speak to this audience in particular.
Absolute pleasure. So, because this is an audio format, I should explain that Patrick's is the American accent and Rob's is the New Zealand accent.
That'd be a Canadian accent, by the way.
Canadian accent. My first faux pas. I'm terribly sorry. I think it might be appropriate, actually, to kick us off by remembering the five lives that were lost. And I know, Patrick and Rob, you knew some of the occupants of the Oceangate submersible that was lost. So I wonder if you'd perhaps just reflect on your memories of those that you did know. Patrick, why don't you kick us off?
Sure. Okay. I knew only two of the people in the sub. One of them was a good friend, dear friend, P.H. Nargileh, who I'd known for almost 25 years, I think. And P.H. was an extraordinary individual and someone that we absolutely adored. My family loved him. He often stayed with us when he was here in Florida with us. And he recently worked with us on a project that we have underway and was over in France, you know, doing what he does so well. He was a brilliant human being, and I had the pleasure of traveling around the world on the Five Deeps expedition with him most recently, and that was a great privilege. PH's knowledge was almost without peer in the industry. He was very highly regarded, very highly respected, and he'll be sorely missed by so many of us in the underwater community.
And Rob, I think you had known him a long time as well, hadn't you?
Yeah, I've been sailing with PH for a couple of decades, and we were involved initially in the Air France 447 search together. We had a shared love affair for the same vessel. He had previously been chief pilot on the Nadir, which we purchased and turned into the Alusia. And that was the vessel that we used for Air France 447. But as Patrick says, tremendous guy and a great lover of the sea and of Titanic in particular. Great shipmate. I also knew Hamish Harding, who had come with us out to Challenger Deep to dive to the deepest point in the world. And again, you know, someone who is powered by the by curiosity and by the need to explore.
And obviously devastating to lose colleagues of such long standing, and I, you know, personally affecting too. So you really, it was not an easy thing to witness the story unfold, obviously.
Yeah, it was dreadful to hear the story unfold. I mean, sadly, you know, I think it was a grave concern of mine for more than 5 years, that OceanGate operation, which I felt was one that would ultimately end in tears. And, you know, I had warned many people about it and cautioned PH extensively, in fact, reprimanded him when I knew he was going out there. I was upset about it because PH is a brilliant guy with an extraordinary background. And I was concerned that PH's presence out there would lend legitimacy to what was going on. And not to mention the concerns I had about his personal safety. So I think it was a tragic thing to witness, or to not witness, but to hear and read about. And it absolutely was all consuming. I think I'm sure it was the same for any of us in the underwater community. You know, the messages that were coming in, the emails, the phone calls, it was relentless. And, you know, sadly, I think one of the things that I feel is most important about this forum and this discussion is to differentiate the stark difference between what OceanGate was doing in that experimental monstrosity, and let's call it what it is, and the carefully and thoughtfully engineered and manufactured products of legitimate builders in this space who create submersibles that are fully accredited and go through an arduous, time-consuming, and very thorough validation process. There is really no comparison between the two. And unfortunately, we have been tarnished by this event, and it's definitely has created a lot of discussion about it. And I think it's important to draw that distinction first and foremost, and to make people understand that the part of the industry that Rob and I are you know, involved with, that is accredited subs that are certified and that go through this very time-consuming and necessarily thorough process, have a 50-year track record of perfect safety, an unblemished track record of perfect safety. And that's really unprecedented in any form of transportation. So I think to draw a line between what happened out there, as tragic as it was and as unfortunate as it was, and the things that we do every day, and we do them in perfect safety, is very, very important.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Well, let's get right into it then, because, I mean, you guys are obviously a vast experience operating it at great depths. And I think you said it, Patrick, a lot of people in your community saw this coming. And Rob, following the implosion, an email that you had written to Stockton Rush, the now deceased, obviously, CEO and founder of OceanGate, was well publicized across channels like the BBC. And you very kindly sent the email to me as well. And it made pretty tricky reading. I mean, you basically said, this is a disaster waiting to happen. You've got to take more care. And he was, not receptive, let's say, to that message, was he?
No, he was completely dismissive. And, you know, I think it's important to remember that at that time, you know, OceanGate were the cool kids on the block. They had a hot new product. They were going to be taking a multi-passenger submersible to the Titanic. And, you know, the minute I found out that it was going to be an unclassed vehicle, that's when the alarm bells rang. But it's one of those situations where when you probe that, when you start to ask questions, it's actually the answers that you're getting that become even more alarming. And perhaps the biggest red flag of all was when one of the senior members of OceanGate, the chief pilot, the director of their marine sort of side of the business, wrote a report which I considered to be very professional, very balanced, non-emotive. It laid out the 23 or 26 things that were wrong with the sub and suggested solutions to those problems. And then watching him, not only, you know, was the report not sort of acted on, he was silenced. He was fired on the spot, and then he was taken to court to keep him quiet, and, you know, basically prosecuted to within an inch of his career and having all his dirty laundry aired in public. I mean, it was a really telling sign that there's something wrong here, and the company knows something's wrong, and that's why they're trying so hard to bury it.
And was that the end of your exchange, that email, the series of emails with Stockton Rush? Was there any further attempt to raise flags?
I mean, there were a series of emails that got increasingly more pointed. They were pretty blunt to start with. That's a, you know, default Kiwi position, to be straightforward. But, you know, you'll see in the tone of the emails, at least from me to Stockton, I'm desperately trying to build a bridge and keep a conduit open, because on one side you had me emailing him direct. On the other side, you had other members of the industry writing to him individually, but also collectively as an industry body. We figured at the time that the more lines of input that Stockton was being subject to, the greater the message, or the more clarity the message might have. The final discussion I had with Stockton was actually over a dinner, and it was a pretty heated exchange, in the sense where I told him in no uncertain terms that he was doing the wrong thing. And he pushed back by suggesting that getting a vehicle or a vessel classed is time consuming and doesn't actually add any safety and serves to blight innovation. And at the time, you know, Patrick was in the process of building the limiting factor, the Triton 36002, the first, you know, commercially available full ocean depth vehicle. And I was able to use elements of that to show that we're working on this project, which is building a sub that goes as deep as it's possible to go. And we're doing that hand in hand with a classification society who are not only being responsive, but they're actually feeding into the design and build process. And of course, I couldn't go too far into it at that time because it was still subject to an NDA. So that's when I introduced Stockton to Patrick, so that Patrick, who was as qualified and permitted to do so, could show Stockton that it is possible to be extremely innovative, like advance, make a huge advance in technology and get sort of third-party certification.
So just to, for everyone listening, limiting factor was the full ocean depth submersible that Triton built and which went down to Challenger Deep. In the first dive was in 2019?
That's right. Well, the first dives were in 2018, but the dives to Challenger Deep occurred in 2019, in the spring.
And Challenger Deep, of course, being the deepest point in the world's oceans.
That's it, yeah. 10,932 meters, in fact, or, you know, about 35,865 feet. So a long way down, three times the depth of Titanic. And yet we were doing that with full involvement with the certification agency, DNV, in this case, was DNV, Germanister Lloyd, but now DNV. And so my argument to Stockton and people like him is that certification, accreditation, is not an impediment to innovation. I would say it is the fertile ground in which innovation can occur, but it can occur responsibly. Now, I often think about my work with DNV on that project, and our principal designer described Jonathan Struve, who's the principal engineer that we worked with on that project at DNV. He described him as a co-designer. He was involved in every aspect in the development of that vehicle. And he was so committed to the accreditation process of that vehicle, he accompanied me on a dive to full ocean depth. So he sat in the sub with me. We went to maximum depth that you can go in a sub. We recovered a lander that was stuck in the mud, and we validated everything about that vehicle. And it wouldn't have happened without DNV. In fact, I would point to that vehicle, which was the first of its kind, is the first of its kind. It's still without peer in our industry, as a great example of what's possible with accreditation, with certification. Because we didn't just build a vehicle that made a single trip to full ocean depth. We've built a vehicle that now has done something like 150 dives over 6,000 meters, 150 dives deeper than 20,000 feet. And it's making those dives at regular intervals, and people can enjoy diving in it and making these extraordinary discoveries and scientific accomplishments, but being able to do it in the comfort and safety of a vehicle that you know has been through the mill, has been through this accreditation process. And that, I think, is what differentiates it from the things that preceded it. You know, the accreditation was a critical deliverable from our perspective with our client.
And the accreditation effectively is the root and branch check by experts about every system and material on board.
That is correct. It is a process that begins at inception, you know, when you're conceiving the design with all of your initial calculations and assumptions, all the way through to the procurement of materials that are an origin that is proven. The materials are then tested and validated to ensure that the characteristics of the materials match the mill certificates, fashioned into parts that meet drawings, assembled into parts that ultimately make up the submarine. And that certification process begins at its inception, but stays with the sub for its entire life. It's very much like the process that an aircraft goes through to be certified. And so it isn't something that you get and then that's the end of it. It has to be renewed each year. It's part of a pledge that you make as a manufacturer to the safety and efficacy of something, and to ensure that it conforms in all respects to manufacturer's requirements, our requirements, but also the requirements of the certification society. This is an independent third-party accreditation agency. They have no affiliation with us. They are looking at the sub objectively, the design, and they want to make sure that it's safe. They have established rules that have developed over 50 years. And we have to comply with those rules, and we have to comply with the annual and special periodical survey requirements that are a necessary part of maintaining that certification. So if we just said that vehicles that are taking people on these type of deep dives have to be certified, we wouldn't be having this discussion right now.
But people might be thinking quite, you know, justifiably, how is it even possible that this operation can basically knock up a sub and then send it out into deep water? And
that's a very good question, by the way. That is the question.
How could it possibly be legal that could take place without certification?
Well, I'll tell you. Think about the guy that puts together an airplane in his garage and then flies it into a mountaintop. You can do that too. The difference is, if you do that and you do it on your own, well, I guess, you know, you paid the ultimate price for making that very careless and reckless decision. If, on the other hand, you've got people who are paying to get in that sub and who may not know the difference between the craft that they're getting in and a craft that's been through the accreditation certification process, that's where it starts to become a little bit, I say, tricky. Because, you know, when you think about this document that people were required to sign, this waiver or disclaimer. I mean, I can only imagine what it would be like if I made people that had to get in one of our subs sign a document like that. I mean, it's the most ridiculous thing possible. You have an expectation of getting in a machine like that, knowing that it is safe. And I think the thing that happened here was it was represented as being safe. He had people sign this document, but there were other things that were being done to help, I'd say, assuage people's concerns about safety, you know, suggesting there was a link between what they did and Boeing, what they did and NASA or what they did and the University of Washington, none of which I think was true, or at least later I've heard they've all, they've all basically disavowed the project and their involvement with it. But, people were getting in that thing, maybe not realizing that they were putting their lives at risk. And I think it's maybe up to us to ensure, to insist that machinery and equipment that's being used in the deep sea meets an internationally recognized set of standards and is operated and maintained by people who are appropriately qualified and experienced.
Well, I think it's also fair to say that there was a lot of effort put into making sure that the OceanGate sub did not trip any of the legal triggers, if you like. You know, the law essentially says that a United States company cannot take a United States person in an unclassed vehicle for hire or reward. And so to unpick at that, it wasn't a United States vehicle. It was registered in the Bahamas. They didn't operate it in the United States. They operated it commercially. They operated it in international waters. People were not passengers. They were mission specialists. So they're given some rudimentary training and called mission specialists to get them around that passenger requirement. And then finally, they didn't buy a ticket per se. They made a contribution to OceanGate. And, there's a little bit of smoke and mirrors goes on there with sort of flying the science banner and saying it's for the good of the ocean. But makes no mistake, coming from someone who's actually operated several commercial trips to the Titanic, at 250K, that's bald-face commercialism. There's not a lot of science that needs to be done at Titanic. It's a very, very well-studied wreck in all regard. And I just want to be a little bit more pointed because I don't want to give anybody a place to hide. This is a sub that was built in the United States by an American company and tested in Puget Sound, off Seattle. When Dave Lockridge, the chief pilot, wrote his report, that report went to OSHA, who are, the people who administer the whistleblower program in Washington State. And OSHA gave it to the Coast Guard. So, people that sort of hang back now and say, oh, well, we didn't know, it's going to look very lame when the investigators come calling.
Mm. And it sounds like, there was some very deft footwork done by the by Stockton Rush to get around these various rules and regulations, as you've demonstrated. But it's not like any of these concerns were unknown. I mean, they were, well publicized, as we've discussed already. So why on earth would people like Hamish Harding and PH, people of vast experience in exploration and deep water, why would they get in that submarine?
Well, that is an excellent question as well, and one that I am going to be wrestling with for the rest of my life, because I couldn't have been more pointed, to use Rob's word, in my condemnation of that vehicle and in my concerns about PH diving in it. I was very, very concerned that he was going out there. I reprimanded him and tried to do everything I could to discourage him from going out there. I know many people that knew him did the same thing. And so I still am trying to understand his motivations for being out there. And naturally, I can't understand it. I do know that when I asked him that, he said to me that, maybe by being out there, I can help them avoid a calamity, a tragedy. I think he genuinely believed that his background, his experience, might be helpful to their operation, and I'm sure to some extent it was, him being out there. But I think it also helped to legitimize what they were doing. Here's this highly regarded member of the deep submergence community out there. It's a tacit endorsement, if you will, of what was going on. And I think even if he did have concerns about the efficacy of that sub, and I'm sure he did, even if publicly on these news interviews I've seen where he says, no, I had no concerns about its safety, I just don't think that's true. He knew how so many of us were concerned about it. There were letters written by the Marine Technology Society. I was a signatory on that letter.
But he wasn't. PH wasn't a signatory.
No, he wasn't. But he knew about it. I mean, and we talked about it openly and candidly. This was something he was aware of, and he knew what the concerns were because we talked about them very, very openly. So the fact that he went out there and went on that dive, I know one of the things was he believed he could maybe help avoid a tragedy. Instead, he found himself in the middle of it, which is kind of ironic. But also, I think he was very drawn to that wreck. I mean, he was so in love with the idea of exploring it. And I think getting the opportunity to be down there again was maybe appealing enough that he was willing to overlook the risk. I don't know. It's supposition on my part, but it's still something that will trouble me always, because I don't think any of us could have been more unequivocal about our concerns. And we certainly voiced them numerous times with him.
I think too that there are some similarities between the two guys. Both of them were pilots. Hamish, a skilled aviator, and PH, a submersible pilot. But pilots don't necessarily have the engineering background required to uncover a fault like this. In Hamish's case, I sat down with him, as I did with, three dozen people who were contemplating going in the Ocean Gate sub, and shared with them the concerns, showed them the industry's correspondence with Stockton, and all bar two declined the offer to go in the sub. Hamish did go in the sub because even though he respected the fact that questions had been raised, there's an opposite spin going on from Ocean Gate. And in the end, the draw of Titanic and the desire to experience that that activity overrode, his analysis of the risk. And I think PH is possibly similar. He's a very accomplished deep water pilot, but not a particularly a big name in the engineering world. And he understood what Patrick was telling him, but I don't think he. Well, he for whatever reason, he made the decision to override that and get in the sub.
Really, it boggles the mind and defies any explanation to me because, as I said, we were so unequivocal in our condemnation of this thing. I mean, it goes back all the way to, I remember even seeing that. I went and saw that thing, I saw that thing in 2019, just coincidentally. I was over in the Bahamas on a March spring break. It was in March of 2019. I was over in the Abacos on a sailboat with my family and taking a holiday. And I was in the bar, as you are, and I was playing ring toss, at the bar, Bahamian ring toss, if you know what I'm talking about there. And I had, Triton t-shirt on, as I generally do. And some young fellows walked up to me and said, "Hey, why do you have that Triton shirt on?" And so I told them. And they said, "Oh, we're over here with a sub," and they started to tell me all about it. Bought a few rounds of drinks, and then they said, "Well, tomorrow we'd like to give you a tour of the sub." So I met them. We went out. They showed me that contraption, the barge that they had the thing on, the submersible barge, the LRT, launch and recovery transport that they used to put that thing in and out of the water, and then the actual sub itself. I walked around over the course of maybe 30 minutes. And this was a young group of brilliant young people, who just had really no idea what they were up against, but they were full of enthusiasm for what they were doing. And kind of reminded me of myself, sort of 40 years before. And so I did my best to walk around and point out the things I was very concerned about, including the obvious, the filament wound carbon fiber hull.
So from that kind of cursory examination of yours, seeing the carbon fiber hull and the titanium end pieces effectively.
It was obvious. There were glaring defects on this. I made this list of things for them to address. And maybe it was coincidental, but about a week later, they claimed the sub was hit by lightning and they canceled their Titanic trip for that summer, thankfully. But I honestly, you know, Stuart, I guess when I looked at that thing, I thought, well, I don't really have to worry too much because there's no way this thing is ever going to, it's ever going to work. It's ever going to see the light of day. It's ever going to carry people. So I think in some ways we were complacent. You know, we kind of fell back on this notion that that this thing would never actually get out of the gate. And if it did, it wouldn't work.
So the list of faults that you basically, you said that's wrong, that's not going to work. You shared that list with the Ocean Gate?
I did. No, I walked around. I was pointing these things out to this group of young people. And you know, as I said, it was such a comprehensive list of stuff that it didn't seem like it was anything that was going to get resolved. And I assumed, like I think a lot of people did, that these guys would run out of gas, that they would just, you know, this thing would just die a natural death. I didn't ever expect they would carry paying passengers or make dives to Titanic. I guess I underestimated his resolve, his ability to raise the funding necessary to address some of these things, but fundamentally unwilling to address the core issue, which was accreditation. I think, you know, I think of myself, I think of the facility that I'm in right now and the people that I work with. And I cannot imagine having a culture where people bringing up safety concerns would be punished. Here at our facility, we encourage people to bring up safety concerns. They are expected to. And it doesn't matter where you are in the food chain. I think you have to have a culture that is focused on safety, that is completely centered on safety as the foundation upon which everything else is built. And that means that, you know, when a safety concern is raised, you don't punish the person for raising it. You vet it in a forthright and straightforward manner until the concern is addressed or you've provided justifiable reasons why it isn't a concern. But, you know, I think, yeah, anyway, I know I've sort of strayed off the mark there, but
No, it's an interesting point because the particular concerns, I'm fascinated by them because obviously I'm not an engineer.
Nor am I. I'm not an engineer.
But you got a lot more experience than me. So perhaps you could just explain, both of you, what was wrong with a carbon fiber hull and titanium ends?
Well, first of all, I think I want to mention something that I think is important here. People kept describing this thing as innovative, you know, this was a brand new idea. It's not a new idea at all. Filament wound submarines are something that have been around for, you know, almost 50 years, 45 years. In fact, the very first subs that I operated were little one-man subs that had a filament wound pressure boundary made of GRP, not FRP, but GRP. And it's interesting, and I don't know whether this is the reason, but I have to assume there's maybe some connection that a few years after I stopped operating these things in the mid-80s, they were all condemned by Lloyd's Registry of Shipping. So why was that? I don't know. I think it probably had something to do with their longevity, with some connection between this filament wound pressure boundary and its gradual degradation over time. You know, and so this notion that they, you know, created something that was brand new that nobody had ever thought of is just simply not true. It was the rehashing of an old idea, but for a much deeper depth.
Well, it sounds like it was an awful lot of marketing.
Well, I think that fundamentally that was the main concern was the efficacy of the filament wound pressure boundary. And the concern, frankly, that it was capricious, that it was a material that was unpredictable, that would degrade over time, and that when it failed, it would fail catastrophically and fail without warning. And I know they talked about they had this early warning system that notified them of, you know, the fibers that were breaking in this thing. But the simple fact that you have to monitor and that you would have something in your design that is unpredictable or capricious and that was degrading over time is the exact reason it should never have carried passengers. This was a vehicle that was not fit for human occupancy. And therefore, it's why I described it as an aberration.
Well, I think you said monstrosity as well, didn't you?
Monstrosity. It is something that should have never carried people. And it'd be one thing if it was a robotic vehicle and, you know, a failure of it just resulted in the loss of equipment. But the fact that human beings were involved means you have to hold yourself to a higher standard. You know, you got to build something that is made of materials that are entirely predictable in how they perform, and that there is no discernible, you know, diminishment in the efficacy of something over time.
So Rob, this failed kind of sub-building 101, didn't it? I mean, it was just not fit for purpose, clearly.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, at the time, there were three big concerns. One was the use of carbon fiber. And you'd have to ask yourself, you know, why is carbon fiber not being used? Well, Stockton never asked that question. He just thought he had a new and innovative thing, and then he ran with it despite everybody telling him that this was bad. The second thing was the use of non-standard equipment on board the vehicle. So, you know, everybody's now heard of the Sony PlayStation controller. I mean, you know, the risk that introduces, unnecessary risk that introduces, is alleviated if you have hardwired controls. There's a reason that every submersible and every aircraft has hardwired controls, you know, to reduce the opportunity for failure between your fingertip and the control surface that you're operating. We need the electricity to get from one place to the other, the signal to get from one place to the other with the minimum of opportunity to fail. And then thirdly, it was just the whole Kool-Aid culture, where anybody that said anything that was negative was sort of belittled and ignored, or in the case of a major player like the chief pilot, was actually taken to court to you know, keep them silent. I mean, none of this is a good look. And, you know, it's interesting that none of us are engineers, but, you know, I was berated last week by an OceanGate previous client who said, "You're not even an engineer. How could you possibly know?" And it's like, imagine sitting on the front seat of an airliner and you're waiting for takeoff, and the pilot comes down the jetway and goes into the cockpit, comes out 10 minutes later and says, "This thing is a death trap. There's no way I'm getting in this," and walks out. You don't need an engineering degree to think, maybe I should get the next flight. You know, the way they treated Dave Lockridge was the primary indication that things were well amiss.
And by the way, on the subject of David Lockridge, you know, Rob told me about what was happening with David, and I felt strongly that his report, which I was never privy to, but which I had heard about, was so damning in its condemnation of the vehicle and the things that were wrong with it. I felt it was essential that that report see the light of day. And when Rob told me that you know, this guy was being berated and fired and punished for bringing up safety concerns, I felt that those safety concerns needed to see the light of day. And I wanted to help him in his fight against this guy. To me, I looked at it as a David and Goliath type situation, you know. So I did. I helped him. Unfortunately, I think he decided that he didn't want to pursue that fight, and you know, it wasn't my decision or my right to tell him that he should or he shouldn't. But I believe strongly at that time that, you know, whenever a legitimate safety concern is raised, that it needs to be addressed in an open and forthright way. And I felt that David, who I knew was a quality individual with a lot of experience, I assumed his concerns were real and legitimate, and that they should be reviewed and carefully considered and acted on by the people at the company.
Well, it's clear that they weren't. The sub went down with five people on board. It imploded on its dive. And then we had this slightly extraordinary global news phenomenon of air running out, etc. But I think what I've been told by various insiders that everyone who really knew it had imploded on the first initial descent. So everyone was watching with kind of open mouths as this story played out over time, and it occupied the front pages when, you know, the sub was lost. And
yeah, sure. I mean, we all expected that it was a catastrophic collapse, which is exactly what happened. And, you know, I suppose on one level, it's a great relief to think that, you know, the poor unfortunate individuals in there didn't suffer. You know, they wouldn't even have known what happened. It would have happened so quickly. Less than a blink of your eye, you know, sort of thing. But of course, then you hear stories about people banging away on something, and you naturally latch on to the possibility that maybe your initial assumptions about what happened, you know, could be wrong.
Hmm.
Wouldn't it be great if they were alive? You know, ultimately, of course, we now know that was just a red herring.
Yeah, and a tragic one for the families too, because I'm sure it would have been quite excruciating.
Well, the whole thing is tragic. It's tragic on so many levels. It's hard to articulate just how upsetting it is, and I can only imagine, you know, the families and what they've had to endure as they've thought about this and their actions leading up to it. I think the only thing we can take away from it is to ensure that something like this never happens again. But I think it's also very important, in addition to doing that, that we continue to have conversations like this to illustrate the stark difference between that Ocean Gate contraption and the beautifully engineered and crafted vehicles that are created by legitimate people in our industry that have taken tens of millions of people on dives over five decades and have done so without incident. So that's important for people to understand. Subs are wonderful machines. They allow you to visit perhaps the most beautiful place on Earth, certainly the place I consider to be the most beautiful on Earth. They allow you to see things you couldn't see any other way. To me, these are magical machines. I have devoted my entire adult life to working with human-occupied vehicles, accredited, certified human-occupied vehicles. They are fantastically fun and interesting, absolutely safe. People don't need to and shouldn't be afraid of them. If you're afraid of something, be afraid of the car that you get into every day. You're you know, hundreds or millions of times more likely to have something happen. But you don't need to be afraid of subs. Subs are wonderful. They're safe. You know, you take your hands off the controls in a sub and you're going to come back to the surface.
Yeah, just on that, because obviously Triton, there's some big news last year. James Cameron, he of Avatar and Titanic fame, was one of the world's most successful storytellers and directors, has invested in Triton. We interviewed him for a piece that will be appearing in the magazine shortly. And he made that exact point in the interview. He said, you know, I spoke to him before the Ocean Gate tragedy, and he said, look, this is much, these subs are much safer than, he said, flying, and also, you know, getting in your car. I mean, they're so rigorously checked when done right, as Triton submarines are, that he feels much more comfortable going down 4,000 meters.
Absolutely. And that is the case. And I think it's important. It's such an important message for people to understand. I mean, we've already had concerns raised about, oh my God, are these things safe? You know, should I really have one of these on my yacht? And the simple answer is yes, you should have one on your yacht. They are absolutely safe. And the track record of 50 plus years of perfect safety and tens of millions of people diving in subs validates that. You know, you don't have to take my word for it. And it's not just because I'm a purveyor of, you know, underwater vehicles. I've been diving in subs my whole adult life. I had my first dive when I was 23, 40 years ago, and or nearly 40 years ago. And I love subs. And every time I get in one, I'm excited to think about what I'm going to see. And I think this is unfortunate because it will throw cold water on the idea because people won't necessarily differentiate. And I think it's up to us to help change the narrative and help educate the market, our market, and the general public about how fun, how exciting, and how safe human-occupied vehicles in the deep sea can be and are when they're operated properly and when they're built and according to, you know, regulations.
Well, you both operate at the cutting edge of this market, really. And Rob, obviously, you were involved in that Five Deeps dive as well. And you've told me some great stories about going to Challenger Deep in the past. But because you are so client facing, I was wondering, have you heard or experienced any blowback from this from clients? Have people kind of demurred instead of saying yes to things in one of your expeditions involving submarines?
It's fair to say that half a dozen people have contacted us to validate a couple of pieces of information. I mean, the way I explain it to them and to journalists is that, you know, comparing the OceanGate vehicle with a class submersible, a professionally built class sub, is like comparing a home-built aircraft, a home-built ultralight, with a Boeing airliner. I mean, yes, they both get off the ground and fly, but the differences in engineering standard is profound. You know, and when I see a home-built aircraft that, you know, falls out of the sky with the owner, inventor, innovator on board, it doesn't make me reconsider my next flight in an Airbus or a Boeing. You know, there's just no comparison. And journalists are often asking, you know, will this force a change in the industry? And it's actually the industry is doing the right thing. The industry's had, as Patrick says, a half century, millions and millions of dives, you know, incident free. The industry is doing the right thing. What this does is it underlines in stark relief and indelible ink that the penalty for straying away from accepted engineering principles is severe. And so, you know, I think it will promote some change in that it'll just become harder for people who might be considering home building or innovating and then sort of sneaking around the rules regarding passengers. That'll stamp that out.
Yeah, and similar to Rob, you know, I've had multiple interactions with clients and with individuals, most of which were related and centered around relief and gratitude when they found out they didn't go on that sub. I mean, I had warned multiple people about it, and a few of my customers who had thought about going out there and making that dive who, you know, made a call and spoke with me as they spoke to Rob as well, you know, quickly realized that it was probably not a good idea to go out there. And so I think that was a good thing. And we did have some people, some clients, prospective clients who start, you know, having concerns about, oh, Jesus, is owning a sub safe? And that's why I think it's incumbent upon all of us who are in this industry and who recognize how much a submersible can enhance the ownership experience of a yacht to make sure people understand the difference between that abomination and the wonderful machines that we create, which give people these great experiences. I mean, they really do enhance the ownership experience of a yacht.
I mean, you know, when we talk about, you know, 50 years and millions of dives, so that's not an exaggeration. I mean, it's calculated that Atlantis submarines, which operate sort of 50, 60, 70 seat subs.
I worked for them for 8 years.
And they still survive. you know, the Atlantis submarines who operate these 50, 60, 70 seat subs at various sort of resort centers around the world, you know, have taken more people underwater than the US Navy has. I mean, they have a very high throughput, you know, and it's a very simple operation in the sense that you pay your money, you go for a ride for an hour, and you get to experience the underwater world. And I took my son on one in Kona, Hawaii, and the people in front of me were from Kansas and the people behind me were from Oklahoma. It's the first time they'd ever been underwater. And it's the first time this whole underwater world had been opened up to them. And the effect on them was incredible.
Yeah.
And that's your typical first ride in a sub experience. I mean, obviously, Patrick and I represent a far end of the spectrum where we're doing science-based dives down to full ocean depth. But for the vast majority of people, their submersible experience is in relatively shallow water, in the sunlight, looking at the fish swimming by, maybe seeing a wreck. You know, going for a ride in a sub is not supposed to be an extreme athlete sport. It's not supposed to be, okay, I'll take the risk and I'll chance it. We do everything we can to make it fun and safe.
Yeah. And you mentioned science, and I think that's important to highlight as well, because this isn't just, I suppose the other negative consequence of the OceanGate disaster was that the public perception is that this is just a bunch of rich guys trying to kind of outdo each other by going deeper or seeing something wackier than the other guy. But I mean, the science aspect is crucial to what you're doing. It's not just tourism or deep sea tourism. There is a research exercise here too.
True statement. I mean, I think the thing I'm most proud of is the subs that we manufacture, which are incredibly versatile. They can be used for pure recreation, or they can be used to film a documentary or to prosecute a complex series of scientific missions. The work that's being done by entities like OceanX, RevOcean, and Necton, and others, and the fantastic documentaries that are being made, you know, using human occupied vehicles, I think are the thing that we really are proud of at Detroit. And I think the stories that come back and the films that people get to watch, I think create excitement. They certainly did with me as a kid. I can point to the Cousteau series as being one of the most inspirational things that happened to me as a kid. And there's no question there was a direct link between those TV series that I would watch and my passion and interest in the ocean. So I think these documentaries that are being created with subs, human occupied vehicles, people often think, well, why do you need, you know, human occupied vehicles? Why don't you just do it all with robots? And robots are great. Yeah, you can use them, and they're certainly one of the tools in the toolbox, but you cannot duplicate the experience of being there and seeing and experiencing these things with your own eyes and taking in that information in real time. It's incredibly powerful and emotive and something that stays with you. And I think that if I can take it even further, I would say that if you give a person an opportunity in a human occupied vehicle, you will have created an ocean advocate forever. And everything you thought you knew and understood about the ocean will change, because you'll get to see it from a perspective that you haven't before. That's the story that we should be focused on. This is tragic and unfortunate, but the thing that we should be thinking about is how fun and exciting and wonderful these machines are and how they allow us to go places we couldn't any other way. And I hope that message doesn't get lost in all the noise that's been created by the OceanGate tragedy.
I'd also like to mention that these individuals that were paying for the experience were wealthy. One of them, Hamish Harding, came out with us last year to dive Challenger Deep. And, you know, we had half a dozen commercial divers who went to full ocean depth. And they paid a pretty penny. You know, they paid $750,000 for that experience. But that money was used to fund the rest of the science program, to keep the science program on pressure drop at that time, to keep that program going for that entire year. Last year, our direct clients spent over $100 million on ocean philanthropy. But the group known collectively as the Pink Flamingos, who are also, you know, wealthy people who sort of contribute to ocean science, ocean philanthropy, they spent in the order of $250 million. And so, you know, being wealthy and being curious, being interested in advancing science and technology is a good thing, not a bad thing. I think OceanGate understood that dynamic and were using sort of a science veneer, if you like, to sell their product. And I sound sort of cynical, and that's because having led many expeditions to the Titanic, and knowing that there's endless books and documentaries and films that have been made about it, there's not too much at the Titanic site that would be new to science. So they were using science as a cover to sort of get past the, you know, to add to the marketing, if you like. But it's a big ocean out there, and there's so much of it that we don't understand. And it's only by having class certified subs that are supporting science and filmmaking, and even private adventure that pays for it, is a good thing, not a negative.
Absolutely. You think about the documentaries that are coming out, that and how much traction they get in the general public. You know, great example is Blue Planet. I think the viewership on that was 4 billion people. If you want to create a groundswell of support for ocean science, ocean exploration, protection of our oceans, ocean advocacy, one of the best ways you can do it is through documentaries like that, which you know, have a leave an indelible impression. They're powerful.
And which used Triton submersibles.
They did. Yeah, they sure did. And we're super proud of that. And incredibly proud of our partnership with OceanX and the extraordinary work they're doing in the ocean space, because they're focused, as we are, on trying to get people excited and engaged with the ocean. And so, as Rob says, you know, you have these wealthy individuals who are pouring their personal resources into ocean science and exploration initiatives, and they're having significant impact. And I mean, rather than throwing rocks at them for doing it, I think we should be happy about it, because I can tell you there's no government money, no public money coming for ocean science and exploration. They're all underfunded, and they're depending on these type of individuals, these forward-thinking and progressive people who are willing to underwrite these ambitious projects and expeditions that allow them to do things that they couldn't do otherwise.
It does seem that where governments have retreated from ocean science, these very wealthy individuals have stepped in. And perhaps there's just not enough recognition. Obviously, there's an element that they enjoy from it. It's not all, you know, producing deep research papers and homework. But the, you know,
yeah, it's great.
But what they're doing by going down there is providing opportunities to learn that otherwise wouldn't have existed.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that affected me so powerfully when they announced my partnership with Ray and then ultimately with Jim.
That's Ray Dalio, the New York the investor. Yeah.
Yeah, Ray Dalio. I beg your pardon. Yeah, you know, we're very proud of the relationship we've had with him for the last 12 years, and we've been supporting his ocean science initiatives and the two subs that he has on his vessel. But when he decided to join as a partner in Triton, that was a super proud moment for me, and as well with Jim. These are people that share my love, my passion for the ocean, and who can do and have done extraordinary things in the ocean space, no question about it. What I can tell you is that when they asked him a question, I think one of the Business Insider or something like that said, you know, Mr. Dalio, why are you, you know, getting involved in a submarine company? And I think when he said that, you know, I'm in my 70s, and, you know, when you get to be this age, you start thinking about the time you've got left and what you want to do with that time. And he said something that I think is quite important. And he said, this is what I want to do with the time I got left. And let's face it, he's an individual that is formidable, and the things that he can do in the ocean space, because it's something he cares personally about, cares deeply about, are profound. And, you know, aren't we all lucky that there are people like that in this world who care about the ocean and who want to leave a mark and help advance our knowledge and understanding of it. And Jim, the same. I mean, he makes films, he says. Remember him telling me, I make documentaries to support my, I make feature films, I'm sorry, to support my underwater documentary film habit, you know.
He said the same thing to me. I found it extraordinary. He said, yeah, I just make these billion-dollar movies. That's just a day job. The real mission is the deep sea.
I can tell you, he loves the ocean. He absolutely loves it. Has his whole life, and I know Ray feels the same way. And I feel lucky to have found a couple of kindred spirits who can, and I'm sure will in the coming years. Even though they've done a lot already, I think there's some exciting things still to come. That's for sure.
So, I mean, we've learned pretty comprehensively from both of you, and I really, really appreciate your time on this. I mean, the Triton approach couldn't be more different to Ocean Gates. And EOS similarly operate only with fully certified and classed submersibles, and safety is paramount in everything that you do. But I wonder how we avoid this situation in the future, because we, you know, you did raise flags, you did blow the whistle on Ocean Gate. Sadly, those warnings weren't heeded with tragic results. But Rob, perhaps you can just comment on how we can avoid this in the future.
I mean, I think that, you know, as much of a sort of dark picture you can paint around Stockton, the Stocktons of the world can only exist if they're in an environment that enables them. And there are two kinds of people in that world. The first are the people who are paid to keep the secret or to overlook the facts. And I'm talking about the lawyers or the people that are involved in silencing the whistleblowers. But the other group of people in there are the people who just simply don't add up the dots. You know, they don't connect the dots, and they don't come to the conclusion that they're being fed hogwash. And I think that for anybody in the maritime industry, if you see something that just doesn't add up, and you don't understand it well enough yourself because you're not an engineer or you're not a mariner or whatever the concern is, ask somebody that you trust who does have that experience, and they'll weigh in. And, you know, I guess it's similar to being an investigative journalist. If you think that you're being misled, ask another question. And if you still think you're being misled, find another source and ask the same question again, and eventually the truth will out. The truth and the Ocean Gate case will all come out in the investigation. Honestly, it was all there in 2016, 2017, 2018. It's just that it was kept quiet. So the message I would like to leave the audience is that if you're a whistleblower, if you've got a genuine safety concern, raise it and don't be silenced until you're sure that you've actually got to the bottom of it.
Yeah. And I think if I can weigh in on the same subject, I think it's even simpler than that. Insist on certification. Insist on third-party independent accreditation as being an essential part of the underwater vehicle, the human-occupied vehicle that you're going to dive in. It's something that is, to me, it's fundamental, it's foundational, it's essential. And I think if we had insisted on that, and if people insist on that in the future, you can be assured that the craft that you're getting in has been reviewed independently by a group of professionals and according to a set of rules that will ensure that it's safe.
I think that's an excellent note on which to draw a close to this conversation. Don't get in a sub unless it's got third-party certification. I think that's a fundamental, and I only wish that those five passengers on Ocean Gate insisted on the same thing.
And by the way, if you know, you think about the track record, as I said, of certified craft, it is without peer. You know, 50 plus years of absolute safety.
Absolutely,
that's a powerful statement and a powerful endorsement for the accreditation process.
Absolutely, Patrick, Rob. I can't thank you enough for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us both as well. I only wish it was on a prompted by a happier occasion than this. And I do hope that eventually we can change the narrative and push that to one side and focus on the more positive aspects of what it is that we do and how much fun and how exciting it is to dive in human-occupied vehicles that are accredited.
Brilliant. Gents, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's Big Boat interview. I hope you found it as fascinating as I did. This episode was mixed and produced by Naomi Wilson and Adam Geist and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we will see you next time.